This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. I'm glad you decided to tune in today. If you are a regular listener, welcome back. Glad to have you. If you're a new listener, let me introduce you to what we do here. We talk about what's going on in the economy. We look at it in terms of what's happened. Historically speaking, when economic times have looked a lot like they look today, and we give you specific strategies to consider for your nest egg, and we also have some educational resources we make available as well. We interview guest experts, and today my guest expert is Mr. Peter Schiff, chair of Schiff Gold, as well as a commentator that you see on a number of different television networks and best-selling author. Mr. Schiff will be joining me momentarily. And on today's program, I'll be comparing the cycles that existed in the 1920s and 30s with the cycles that exist today. I'll do that in the second segment of today's program. And in the fourth segment, I'll ask the question, is the Federal Reserve an asset bubble machine? Are the prices of stocks, are the prices of bonds, and are the prices of real estate, in particular maybe your house, inflated due to Fed policy? I think you'll find that conversation to be quite interesting. And on next week's program, I'll consider those same questions with Mr. Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. You won't want to miss that as well. Quick reminder, the last new retirement rules class of the summer is coming up on July the 25th. That's a Saturday. The class begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. If you'd like more information on the class or you'd like to register while we have space remaining, all you have to do is visit the website, newretirementrules.com. The website is newretirementrules.com. You can register there or get more information on the class. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Peter Schiff. Peter is a well-known economic commentator. He is a best-selling author, also chairman of Schiff Gold. And Peter, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back on the program.
Peter, let's talk about the Fed's recent action deciding not to raise interest rates. Did that come as a surprise to you?
No, not at all. I mean, I never believed that they were going to raise interest rates in June. You know, when the year began, most people were divided between whether or not the Fed would raise in March or June. And now they're trying to debate September or December. I still think they're not likely to raise rates at all in 2015. And by 2016, we'll probably be in such a bad economy, maybe recession, that they'll be doing QE4.
You know, Peter, the Fed revised downward their estimates for economic growth, and yet a lot of folks I interview believe that we may be in a recession currently. What's your take?
Well, it's quite possible. I mean, the first half, the first quarter was a negative quarter, which means if the second quarter were to turn out negative as well, then we're in a recession. Although, you know, the way the government calculates it with their low assumption of inflation, it's pretty hard to get into a recession nowadays because they assume that inflation doesn't exist. In fact, in the first quarter, they assumed inflation was negative. So they actually added back, they inflated the GDP rather than deflating it, which is what they normally do. So when the government is lying so pervasively about inflation and underestimating it by such a large amount, they can create the illusion that the economy is growing even as it's in recession.
Peter, let's talk about that for a bit. We have talked about how the reporting of the inflation information is manipulated with, you know, hedonic adjustment, substitution, things like that. What would you estimate the actual inflation rate to be?
Well, I don't even know how to estimate it because it would just be a guess, right? Because I don't even have any real data. But I certainly don't think it's zero like the government is claiming. I mean, I look at the things that I buy. And, you know, a lot of things that are billed, you know, where I get a bill, you know, my satellite radio, I have XM satellite. So between last year and the year before, they increased my rate by 7%. I have a pool service that cleans my pool every year. You know, they take care of it in the summer because I'm in Connecticut. Well, I got the bill for this year, and it's 10.5% higher than the bill last year. The service is identical. And I can go on and on. I mean, food prices. I mean, look at the cost of beef. Buy a hamburger, buy a steak, you know, buy some eggs, you know. I mean, prices are going up across the board. I mean, I don't really experience, look at rents, Look at how much rents are going up. I mean, medical bills, insurance, everything is getting more expensive, and the government claims that nothing is more expensive. So obviously, they're not true. It's not true. But I have no idea how high it is, but I think it's quite a bit higher than the official estimates. I'm sure it's at least 3 or 4%, if not more. And if that's the case, we've been in a recession for the entirety of the Obama presidency, which makes a lot of sense to me, considering the collapse in the labor force participation rate, all the people who are no longer working in this economy. It makes sense that we have a smaller economy today than we did when the president was elected.
So, Peter, let's talk about this whole inflation-deflation discussion. I've had guests on the program that insist that because we have such high levels of debt in the private sector and, of course, in the public sector as well, that the overriding economic trend will have to be deflation. And yet, when you look at the Fed's easy money policies, I have other guests that say we can't help but have inflation. Can you kind of help our listeners sort that out?
Yeah, well, I'm actually in both camps. It depends on what you're measuring prices in. If we're going to define deflation as falling prices, right? If you're going to measure prices in terms of gold, then yes, prices for everything are going to come down. You're going to be able to buy a lot more stuff with your gold in the future than you can today. But if you're going to measure prices in terms of dollars, right, the paper dollars that we create out of thin air, then we're going to have rising prices, right? We're not going to have falling prices. The price of everything is going to go up in terms of U.S. currency because we're going to print so much of it. Yes, we have a lot of debt, and that's why the Federal Reserve has to keep interest rates at zero, because if they let interest rates go up, we'd have to default on the debt. So in order to delay the default or, you know, just postpone it indefinitely, they have to keep interest rates at zero or practically zero indefinitely. And the only way they can do that is to create massive inflation. They have to keep on printing money and devaluing the dollar. And so the people who are expecting dollars to gain value are wrong. They just do not understand the dynamic here, and they're preparing themselves for substantial losses if they're trying to take refuge in U.S. Treasuries or CDs, or if they're stuffing cash under their mattress. They really should be buying gold, you know, because if you think that prices are going to be down, it's only going to be down in gold. So you better hold that. It's not going to be down in dollars.
So, Peter, let's talk about the stock market, because this past week we saw the NASDAQ get back over the 5,000 mark. I think it's been 15 years since it's been there, and on a nominal basis we've seen the Dow increase since 2000 by about 50%. To what extent are these stock prices attributable to the Fed's easy money policies?
Well, I mean, they're a direct consequence of it, and, you know, the same thing was true the last time the NASDAQ got to 5,000 in early 2000. And, you know, in less than 2 years, by November of 2002, the NASDAQ was down to 1,100. I mean, so you had an 80% decline when that bubble popped. So, you know, we're back in that nosebleed territory. And the last time this happened, the last time the Fed's cheap money policies resulted in NASDAQ 5,000, it ended horribly for the people who were invested in the NASDAQ at 5,000. So it's pretty dangerous. But, you know, I think the Fed is acting much more recklessly now than it was back then. And so I think rather than a collapse in the stock market, what I think is more probable is a collapse in the dollar. Right? In order to prevent the stock market from collapsing, they'll sacrifice the dollar. But in terms of gold, I think the NASDAQ could have a bigger decline in the next few years than it did, you know, when it dropped 80% in terms of dollars.
Peter, we've got a little over a minute left in this segment. Explain to the listeners this whole idea of pricing stocks or pricing assets in gold.
Well, it's a way to keep track of the real value. You know, gold is money, right? And you can keep track of things. You know, how many ounces of gold does it take to buy the Dow, rather than, you know, how many dollars do I need to buy the Dow, and then keep track of that. I mean, you know, in 5 years, will you need more gold to buy the Dow, or will you need less? And I think you'll be able to buy the Dow for a lot less gold. You know, if you look at the historic lows in 1929 or 1932, rather, was the bottom, and then again in 1980, right, you could buy the Dow for about an ounce of gold. I mean, we're way above that now. I forget the ratio. It's above 10, it's 12 or something like that. But at the lows in 2009, we got down to around 8. But we were up at 40 or so at the peak in 2000. You know, it was, you needed 40 ounces of gold to buy the Dow or something like that. So we've been in a major bear market since then. But I think we're going back down close to 1-to-1. So, you know, in order to buy the Dow with an ounce of gold, you know, gold would have to come up to 18,000, right? Or the Dow would have to go down to 1,200, or the two would have to meet somewhere in the middle, which I think is more probable. Maybe they'll meet at 10,000 at some point. Who knows? Maybe they'll meet at, you know, at a lower price or a higher price, but I do think that you're going to get within, you know, that range somewhere. Maybe it won't go all the way to 1-to-1. Maybe it'll be 2-to-1, you know. But that would still mean a big drop in the price of the Dow, you know, relative to the price of gold.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. In the next segment, I will continue my conversation with Mr. Peter Schiff, who is chairman of Schiff Gold. Stay with me. We'll be right back. This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're with me today. I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Peter Schiff in the next segment. You know, in our new retirement rules class and in the new retirement rules book, we talk about the idea of economic cycles or economic seasons. I think many of you, if not maybe most all of you listening to the program today, would agree that human behavior tends to be predictable. Certainly, when you look at the behavior of groups of people in certain situations, we could probably all agree that groups of people faced with the same sets of facts and circumstances tend to behave in similar ways. Well, that's really the premise for the idea of these economic cycles or economic seasons. Now, there are four economic cycles named after the seasons of the year. And in the interest of time today, I'm just going to focus on two of these seasons or two of these cycles. The first is the autumn cycle. The second is the winter cycle. During an autumn cycle, which we believe occurred from 1982 to 2000, you have plentiful money. You've got a massive bull market, rather. You have much speculation. But the most important characteristic to keep in mind of the autumn cycle is that debt levels become very high. In fact, debt levels rise to levels that are unsustainable, and that's the trigger that brings on the winter cycle. During the winter cycle, an economy experiences a crippling credit crisis and money becomes scarce. We've certainly seen some of that already in this winter cycle, with the failure of some banks back during the financial crisis and a bailout of other banks that were considered to be too big to fail. You have massive levels of bankruptcy. You have pension funding problems. That was certainly one of the primary causes of the Detroit bankruptcy. Certainly we believe that we haven't seen the last of those news stories either. And the most important thing to remember is, again, that debt during this winter cycle has to be purged from the system. Well, as this debt is purged from the system, there are economic consequences that are not all that pleasant. There's certainly some evidence that the current winter cycle in which we find ourselves could tend to be worse than the prior winter cycle that we saw during the 1930s. And that all has to do with the levels of debt that exist. I'm going to give you an article that was published on Fox News not long ago that gave these facts. In 1929, when you take a look at the level of U.S. government debt, U.S. government debt was about 20% of the economy. Today, government debt is much higher. In fact, the official U.S. government debt is in excess of $18 trillion, not to mention there are over $100 trillion of unfunded liabilities. Now, what are unfunded liabilities? Well, these are promises that have been made to pay certain benefits. A couple of these big unfunded liabilities might be Social Security and Medicare, just to name a couple. So in 1929, the federal government wasn't broke. Today, the federal government's official debt is more than 100% of the economy. In 1929, about 20% of the economy. Then you look at private sector debt. Forget about government debt for a minute, which certainly is a factor, but if you look purely at private sector debt in 1929, it was about 240% of the economy as measured by gross domestic product or GDP. Simply put, what that means is that for every dollar in economic output in 1929, there was about $2.40 in private sector debt. Today, for every dollar of economic output, there's about $3.60 of private sector debt. Now, here is the bottom line. If there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. And if there's too much debt to be paid, it means that money will disappear from the financial system, causing banking problems like we saw back during the financial crisis. Certainly, we're seeing the approach of that once again in Europe. And the reason for this is that over 95% of today's money is debt. Less than 5% is currency. Well, think about that. If over 95% of money is debt and there's too much debt to be paid, that means the money supply will contract and we will see a deflationary cycle. Well, deflation tends to be painful. Asset prices reset. Real estate prices drop significantly. The stock market declines. And although we haven't seen that yet to a great extent presently, we have seen stock market declines and real estate declines already in this winter cycle, only to see those asset prices recover because of the actions, in my view, of the Federal Reserve. Going back to 1929, in 1929, most of our states were not bankrupt. One county today, we talked about this on the Everything Financial Radio program just a few weeks ago, Cook County, which includes Chicago, now owes over $100 billion in debt. And the largest part of this, unfunded government employee pensions. In 1929, we didn't have 21 million government employees with high salaries, big pensions at retirement, and free health care for life. And yet today, one out of five federal employees earn more than $100,000 per year. In fact, 77,000 federal employees earn more than the governors of their states. I find that statistic to be amazing and alarming at the same time. 77,000 federal employees earn more than the governors of their states. Many employees of government retire at a young age with $100,000 a year pensions for life. At the state and local levels, there are also pension underfunding problems, significant pension underfunding problems. There are nearly $4 trillion in unfunded pension liabilities for state government employees. There's no possible mathematical way to pay these bills moving forward. And the eternal truth is, if there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. In 1929, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid didn't exist. The federal government had no such obligations, threatening to consume the entire federal budget within just a few years. In 1929, there was no federal disability program, and today almost 11 million Americans are on disability. There are more citizens on the disabled rolls than the population of 39 out of 50 of our states. There are more citizens on the disabled rolls than the population of 39 out of 50 of our states. So if there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. What will happen? What will be the consequences? We think one of the consequences will be a major asset pricing reset. On next week's program, I'll be talking to Ian Gordon about what some of these consequences might look like. But in the meantime, if you'd like to get some more information, I'd invite you to go check out our website, newretirementrules.com. That website lists the information for our last New Retirement Rules class of the summer. It will be held on July 25 at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. All the details are there. We talk about debt levels, outcomes, and give you specific strategies you might consider for your situation at the class Again, the website to check it out, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money, just give me money.
Monday, 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 always Sunday in the rich man's world.
This is Everything Financial Radio. I have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Peter Schiff. Peter is a well-known economic commentator and analyst. You've probably seen him on any number of TV networks. He's also a best-selling author, also chair of Schiff Gold. We're enjoying our conversation with him. And Peter, if one of our listeners wants to learn more about your work, what would you have them do?
Well, I mean, I've got stuff all over the internet. I mean, my main website for financial commentary and for my brokerage service is Euro Pacific Capital's website at europac.com, EUROPAC.com. Of course, I also have stuff on my Schiff Gold website at schiffgold.com. That's my last name, S-C-H-I-F-F-gold.com. But you can hear my podcast at schiffradio.com, and you can watch my video blogs on my YouTube channel, Schiff Report. I put out a lot of content, and of course, people can read my books. My most recent book, which you can get, you know, Amazon or you know anywhere they sell books, probably, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. That's my most recent book, and of course, I've got, you know, I've written about six altogether. So there's plenty of information out there that I've been putting out to help, you know, help you understand the situation and the importance of preparing for what's to come.
All right, well, Peter, let me go back and let's explore something you mentioned in the last segment. It was that you imagined that we would see this dollar bubble burst. Talk about what a dollar bubble is. Explain it to the listeners, if you would, please. And then what will it look like and how will our listeners be affected in your view?
Well, any bubble is when you have a bunch of people just irrationally buying something and paying a price for it that's, you know, inherently more than the asset itself is worth. And I think you have a lot of people that have been buying dollars, not because they need dollars to buy American products, because we don't really make that much stuff that anybody wants, right? They're just buying dollars because they think the dollar is going to get more valuable. You know, they just wait the way people might have bought Beanie Babies. You know, they're just gambling on the appreciation. But everybody is just holding on to the asset, looking to, you know, to sell the dollar for a profit at some point. And they're almost like, you know, self-generating Ponzi schemes, these bubbles. But the rationale, supposedly, for buying the dollar is that the U.S. economy is now recovered and the Fed's going to be raising rates. And because of those higher rates, the dollar is going to be more attractive. And people are trying to buy the dollar based on this scenario of a strength in the U.S. economy and tighter monetary policy. But nobody is connecting the dots to discover that whatever economic growth people assume is taking place, you raise interest rates and all that growth disappears and we're back in recession because the economy is completely dependent and addicted to cheap money. You take away the cheap money, you take away everything that was built on the foundation of cheap money. All the jobs go away, the stock market plunges, the real estate market plunges, and we're right back where we were in the depths of the Great Recession and financial crisis, only in worse shape. And so when people figure this out, that the Fed didn't solve our problems, it made them worse, and that we need an even bigger dose of this monetary heroin, you know, to stay high and to keep from having to deal with these problems, that's when the bottom is going to drop out of the dollar, you know. And I think that's coming soon. You know, I think the dollar has probably already peaked. Right? The dollar peaked out around March, and it's been slowly declining since then, over the last few months. But I think the pace at which the dollar is falling is going to pick up in the second half of the year.
Well, we're chatting with Mr. Peter Schiff today. If you're just joining us, he is chair of Schiff Gold. Peter, worldwide, we seem to have this race to the bottom as far as fiat currencies are concerned. And a number of analysts out there would say, buy the dollar because, to use the analogy, it's the best house in a bad neighborhood. What would you say to that analogy?
I think it's flawed. I mean, I think we're going to win the race to the bottom. And, of course, that's one race you don't want to win. But we're not, you know, in a good neighborhood. I mean, we are a bad house, you know, but, you know, but we're in a pretty bad neighborhood. We're in a, you know, we're in a neighborhood in and of itself because I don't think, you know, nobody else lives in this neighborhood as far as the enormity of our problems. But the thing is that when people are worried about problems, they tend to buy the dollar as a safe haven, even though the problems in the countries that they're worried about are small compared to the problems in the U.S. But because we benefit when everybody is worried about problems, you don't grasp the gravity of our problems because because our problems have to do with the debt and our inability to repay it. But if more and more people want to loan us money because they're worried about Europe or they're worried about Japan, it just delays the day of reckoning for us. But because all that means we now have more debt, then our problems get bigger. And so one day, when people stop worrying about Europe or Japan, and when our creditors want their money back, that's when it hits the fan, because we can't pay them back. And we can't pay them enough interest to encourage them not to want their money back, because we can't afford it. You know, the highest rate that we can afford is about zero.
Let's talk about currencies, Peter. Worldwide, I believe this is the first time in recorded monetary history that every currency in the world is a fiat currency. Are there any bright spots out there as far as currencies are concerned, or are you advising people to avoid fiat currencies and go to a tangible asset like gold?
Yeah, well, gold is just one asset that we encourage people to own, and we have our clients owning stocks around the world as well, income-producing actual assets, you know, that represent real property, plant equipment, resources, you know, income streams. But we try to get them in the currencies that we think have the least to lose, you know, currencies where the monetary and fiscal policies are not as reckless as they are in the United States. But you're right, none of the currencies are really backed by anything, and I think that's going to change. I think when we do have a dollar crisis, I think a lot of countries are going to look to back their currency with gold, which was the case prior to the U.S. dollar standard. Everybody backed their currency with gold. Now, nobody backs their currency with gold. For a while, everybody was backing their currency by dollars, and the dollar was backed by gold. But when the U.S. went off the gold standard, we took the rest of the world off the gold standard with us, and now we're all suffering as a result. But I think we're going to be going back to a gold standard, and you know, it's not going to be America leading the way, but I think the collapse of the dollar is going to be the catalyst for the world to move back towards real money, you know, backing your currency with actual money being gold.
So, Peter, what currencies do you like presently?
Well, you know, if you look at the currencies that we own for our clients, you know, whether it's through the stock market or through the bond market, but we own the Swiss franc, which is, you know, we own the New Zealand dollar, we own the Singapore dollar, we own the Norwegian kroner, and then we own, you know, some others. We have the Aussie dollar, we have the Canadian dollar, we've got, you know, some Chilean pesos, or, you know, we've got some other currencies in Southeast Asia. And, you know, we have a decent basket of various currencies, but we do try to avoid the problem areas, you know.
Peter, when you look at China over the past several years has been a massive importer of gold, and they've also really cranked up their production of gold. Do you see that China might be the first currency to maybe go back and tie their currency to gold at some point in the future?
They may well be. I mean, we don't know how much gold they have, but I think they've been buying a lot of it. Right now, their currency is already pegged to something. It's pegged to the dollar. And so they seem that they might want to change that, you know, because most currencies aren't pegged to anything. They just float, right? It's whatever they happen to be worth. But China is trying to back its currency or tie it to something else. And I think they realize that what they've tied it to is flawed, you know, and they need to tie it to something else. I don't know that they want to just have it, you know, without any kind of real backing by anything. So I think to go from a yuan backed by dollars to a yuan backed by gold makes a lot of sense. And it'll only strengthen the underlying value of the yuan to have the stability of gold rather than the instability of the dollar backing it up.
Peter, I want to go back to this dollar bubble that you think may be close to actually bursting. When you look at the fact that international transactions are still done for the most part in dollars, although the dollar's lost a lot of market share in the last 15 years, what would you say to those who say that the dollar's got some life left in it because there's no really good viable alternative for a world reserve currency?
Well, it does have some life, but it is quickly losing that life, and as it eventually will be gasping for air. I mean, the transactions in dollars continue to decline every year. More and more countries are signing bilateral trade agreements outside the dollar, and we've actually accelerated that process through FATCA and other regulations and massive fines that have been levied on foreign banks. We're making it very expensive to deal in dollars, and we're creating all sorts of incentives not to deal in dollars. So we're actually hastening its demise by these bad decisions. And so, yeah, this is going to happen. And, you know, nothing has to replace the dollar. As I said, we don't have to have a reserve currency. I mean, the British pound was a reserve currency before the dollar, or the Spanish peseta might have been, or I think the Dutch had a reserve currency. A lot of countries have issued a currency that was predominant in global trade, but we don't have to have one. And of course, gold can replace the dollar very easily as a means of reserve to back up your currency. And, with the way foreign exchange markets operate, I mean, we don't need one currency to denominate all of our trade. There can be multiple currencies that work for global trade. Or, the world can go back to gold. I mean, gold is very easy to transact in these days. You can digitize it. Banks can store gold, and you can spend it very easily. Gold can be transferred electronically now from one owner to another. So we could easily go back on a gold standard, and gold could be, the money that everybody invoices things in.
Peter, last question in the time we have left. We're entering another presidential election cycle. Do you see anything happening politically, or do you see any candidate that is addressing these issues that maybe our listeners should be aware of?
Yeah, I don't know, if any candidates are addressing these issues, because that's not how you get votes, right? I mean, you have to have your talking points that are designed to resonate with your voters. And most voters couldn't even understand the stuff we're talking about, let alone care about it. So I don't think any of the candidates really are making this the centerpiece of their campaign, right? Everybody wants to talk about, the easy things. I'm for a balanced budget amendment. I'm for, strong defense, or, whatever they want to say. I want to balance, I'm for term limits. I mean, easy things. But I do think that there are some candidates, certainly one in particular, Rand Paul, that understands these problems. And I think that he knows what's coming. But again, I don't think it's something that he's choosing to make a campaign issue. He doesn't need it as a stump speech, because, they're trying to get votes. So it's a real it's a political decision as to what you focus a campaign on.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Peter Schiff, chair of Schiff Gold. Peter, always a pleasure to chat with you and have you on the program. Appreciate your insights.
Yeah.
Hope you'll come back.
Yeah, anytime.
We will return after these words. Stay with us. This is Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I want to take a moment once again and thank our special guest expert today, Mr. Peter Schiff, for joining us. In this segment, I want to share a piece that I found very interesting. I found the piece actually in the Wall Street Journal. It was written by a gentleman by the name of Mr. Ruchir Sharma. Mr. Sharma is the head of emerging markets and global macro at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He's also the author of the 2012 book titled Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. The piece talks about the fact that the Federal Reserve, by keeping interest rates at zero, really since the financial crisis, and by engaging in quantitative easing or money printing, has created, in Mr. Sharma's opinion, and I would agree, asset bubbles. In fact, the op-ed piece is titled The Federal Reserve Asset Bubble Machine. The subtitle is Easy Money is Driving Up the Price of Stocks, Bonds, and Houses and Other Assets in an Era Without Historical Precedent. It's important for you to understand the points that Mr. Sharma is making in this article, in my view, and it's important for you to carefully consider them, particularly if you have assets in stocks and bonds, and if you have a 401k or 403b or other retirement account, the chances are pretty good that you probably do. The article was published about a month ago in May, and I will give you just a bit from the article. Mr. Sharma writes, Janet Yellen's comment last week at the International Monetary Fund headquarters in Washington, D.C., that stock prices are quite high, hardly captures the frothiness in U.S. financial markets. The Federal Reserve Chair's admission also stops short of acknowledging the role of free money in inflating the price of stocks, as well as the price of bonds, houses, and every other financial asset. I talked last week on the Everything Financial Radio program that when money is created, it will find a home. And when money is created and looks for a home, could it be that the home it's finding today are stocks, bonds, and houses once again? Mr. Sharma continues, at Morgan Stanley Investment Management, we have analyzed data going back two centuries and found that until the past decade, no major central bank had ever before set short-term interest rates at zero, even in periods of deflation. Mr. Sharma is basically stating that the action of the central bank today, the Federal Reserve, is unprecedented. He continues, to critics who warn that pumping trillions of dollars into the economy in a short period is bound to drive up inflation, today's central bankers point to stagnant consumer prices and say, look, Ma, no inflation. But this ignores the fact that when money is nominally free, strange things happen. And today's record low rates are fueling an unprecedented bout of inflation across asset prices. And the asset prices Mr. Sharma is referring to are housing, stocks, and bonds, something that probably affects many of the folks listening to the program today. The Fed's defenders, Mr. Sharma writes, quibble that houses are less pricey than in the bubble of 2007, or that stocks are less pricey than in 2000, which misses the difference this time around. In the past 50 years, valuations of U.S. stock prices have been higher than they are now for less than 10% of the time, and similar figures hold for bonds and for houses. This kind of synchronized boom has never happened, not even before the last two major meltdowns. My research team's composite valuation for the three major financial assets in America, stocks, bonds, and houses, is currently well above levels reached during the bubbles of 2000 and 2007. Again, in my opinion, proving the point that when money is created, it will find a home. Mr. Sharma continues, stating, faith in the Fed's easy money policies has encouraged a dangerous complacency. The mantra on Wall Street is that good economic news is good news for the markets, but that bad news is also good news because it will encourage the Fed to keep rates lower for longer. This has led to one of the longest rallies the U.S. stock market has ever experienced without even a 10% correction. Returns since 2012 are the highest for any three-year period in recorded history after adjusting for the risk of holding stocks. The Fed's approach has spread to central banks all around the world, creating a new world in which investment decisions are guided by the availability of easy money, not opportunity. This, in my view, is an illusory world. Over the past 3 years, global stock prices have risen rapidly despite tepid economic growth. If you think about it and apply a little common sense, that doesn't square. How can stocks continue to go up rapidly when the economy's growth is not keeping pace? Mr. Sharma writes, oh well, the central bank responds, we target consumer prices, not assets. Central bankers are still fighting to control consumer prices, only now for the opposite reason. Rather than raising interest rates to contain consumer spending and inflation, they hold rates down to encourage spending and induce inflation because the global inflation rate of 2% is dangerously low in their view. The fear is that slowly rising prices will tip into falling prices, and that's deflationary. The boogeyman, Mr. Sharma writes, is not hyperinflationary Germany of the 1930s, but deflationary Japan of the 1990s, when the country fell into a downward spiral of falling prices, weak demand, and stagnant growth. Japan taught the world two lessons, Mr. Sharma writes, that consumer price deflation is bad for growth and that it is hard to shake. Both are inaccurate. Before World War I, many nations experienced deflation, sometimes driven by weak demand and leading to weak growth, but is often driven by rising productivity and accompanied by strong growth. A recent Bank for International Settlement study on the post-war period found that long bouts of deflation were exceedingly rare, but short bouts were common. Every major economic shock in recent decades, Mr. Sharma writes, has been preceded by an asset bubble. That's an important point to understand. Every major economic shock in recent decades has been preceded by an asset bubble. There's the example of housing and stocks before Japan's meltdown in 1990. And before the Asian financial crisis in 1998. There were stocks before the U.S. dot-com bust in 2000. Housing again before the crisis in 2008. Strikingly, Mr. Sharma writes, even as asset prices were climbing before the busts of 2000 and 2008, the Fed kept monetary policy loose because consumer prices were rising only moderately. That's the same excuse we hear now amid a price boom in stocks, houses, and bonds. Mr. Sharma writes, it is true that bubbles are most dangerous when people are borrowing heavily and are buried by debt when the bubble collapses. Mr. Sharma concludes that the Fed now leads a culture of central bankers who see their job as reducing unemployment and stabilizing prices for consumer goods only, come what may in the markets. He writes, this needs to change. In a world in which high trade and money flows tend to restrain consumer prices, but magnify asset prices, in other words, create bubbles, central banks need to take responsibility for both. You know, we believe that we do see asset price bubbles in stocks, houses, and bonds at this point. Predicting when these bubbles might collapse, when these bubbles might burst, is difficult. There's an old saying that the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. There's certainly some truth to that. However, there may be some strategies you should consider for your existing portfolio. Strategies you might consider adopting to help you manage your nest egg. And we talk about those at our new retirement rules class. We've got one more class coming up this summer. It'll be on July 25. That is a Saturday. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. The cost for the class is just $49. That covers the cost of lunch for you and a guest. The book, New Retirement Rules, and all the class handouts. The class begins at 9. It concludes at 2:30 p.m. And again, more information is available at newretirementrules.com. We're also holding several Social Security maximization workshops in the area. It's another free resource available from us here at Everything Financial Radio. All you have to do to get more information or register for one of these workshops is go to socialsecuritydinner.com, socialsecuritydinner.com, and information will be posted there. That's our program for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Bye.